Good morning, Council. To both of you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
We have two matters on for oral argument via ITV. First case is Jones versus State of Minnesota. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument, and the appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that attorneys identify themselves for the record before they begin their presentation. Council, you may proceed.
May it please, Your Honors. Council, my name is Bo McGraw. I represent Rhonda Renee Jones, and we're here on appeal of her post-conviction relief motion, which was denied out of St. Louis County. Ms. Jones has an unfair sentence. She was sentenced to 158 months for a first-degree controlled substance case when, if she would have, she was sentenced to that. She filed an appeal and she felt that the sentence was unfair. While consulting with her appellate attorney at the public defender's office, she was advised that she did not have an appeal that would be successful and that she should go ahead and dismiss the appeal. She did that on February 25 of 2016. What did we know about February 25 of 2016? We knew at that time that under consideration, in fact, what had already been passed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was something known as the Judge Drug Sentencing Reform Act. And what that meant for somebody situated similarly to Ms. Jones is that for her conviction, the sentence, rather than 158 months, the presumptive sentence would be 125 months, almost 3 full years difference, which she is now serving that time. We brought a motion alleging ineffective assistance of counsel based on the advice that Ms. Jones received, where she was advised that she should dismiss her appeal. We brought the motion, and we weren't granted an evidentiary hearing. This is why I believe that the court erred and that Ms. Jones should have been granted an evidentiary hearing. The reason is that it was no secret that the Drug Sentencing Reform Act was passed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It should have been no secret to her appellate counsel at the time, or at least that's something that we would be able to determine in the course of a hearing, an evidentiary hearing. It's my understanding that the Chief Public Defender of the Appellate Division is a standing member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and or somebody from the Public Defender's Office would be a member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
And so certainly, Mr. McGraw, let me stop you a second because, you know, you're talking merits here, but the court dismissed you on timing, too, saying that the petition wasn't timely. And the one thing we do know is that when the appeal was dismissed in 2016, there was a 2-year window to file your claim or to file the petition. Kirby was decided in 2017 in July, so there was still 6 months after Kirby was decided where this petition could have been filed within the original 2-year time frame. So how did the district court err in dismissing the matter out just because the matter wasn't timely?
Of the sentencing guidelines wasn't fully fettered out until all of the Kirby cases went forward. And I cite in my brief a number of those cases under the last part of my argument. And it's my contention that if you look at those cases and when those cases were decided, that once this area of the law was settled, she falls within that. That she brought then her post-conviction relief motion within 2 years of when those cases resolved themselves. I cite for the court State v. Kirby, I cite State v. Otto. Those are the cases that I cite for the court. I thought I cited a third one, but I cited both of those cases.
Well, they're both in July of 2017, which is still well within 2 years of the dismissal of her appeal. Why do you get to the interest of justice if they're still within the initial 2-year period?
Well, the court, if it's time barred, the court can go through an analysis, and one of those criteria is whether some fundamental unfairness needs to be addressed by the court. and whether or not there was any error on her part for not bringing this forward. We're talking about somebody that didn't have the ability to find a lawyer until she was able to find me. And we brought this case forward as soon as we could thereafter. We're very close to that six-month time limit. It seems to me that somebody that's... if you compare her case to somebody else that would have just let their appeal go forward, would have shown up, could have even waived their right to make an oral argument. The court could have issued an order consistent with denying that person's appeal. That person would still receive the benefits that we all know came from the Drug Reform Act. She should receive those same benefits in this case, I respectfully ask of your honors. One of the issues that I have with this is that she should be granted an evidentiary hearing. She should have an opportunity to ask the appellate counsel whether or not the appellate counsel received training on the Drug Sentencing Reform Act, meaning whether or not the appellate counsel, through the public defender's office, received knowledge that there was, in fact, this Drug Reform Act that was in the works, and did receive information about the potential timing of when the legislature may take action on it. Those are questions, I think, that she should be allowed to ask this attorney. And if the attorney acknowledges that he was aware of the Drug Reform Act and that was aware that it was going to be placed before the legislature during that spring session, that's something that I think is material to her issue. And I would ask that you grant her an opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing. We're talking about 3 years of her life here, Your Honors. But unless the court has any other questions, I don't have any other comments.
Questions for sure.
No.
No, thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
So does it switch over to Duluth then, or what?
Sure.
The person needs to talk.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
There you go.
Yes. We can hear you.
Can you see me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Holitz on behalf of the St. Louis County Attorney's Office. It's the state's position, as laid out in our briefing, that Ms. Jones, appellate here, received a guideline sentence. She received a proper sentence. She received a fair sentence. And her case was final long before the Kirby decision was decided. There are, from my perspective here, there are two issues that this court can decide, two issues decided by the district court, and they're both dispositive. And I think the first and most important is the issue that was already addressed by your honors, and that is the timeliness, or as I would say, the untimeliness of appellant's post-conviction motion, or 590 claim. The district court did not abuse its discretion by denying that 590 post-conviction motion as untimely. We know that Minnesota Statute 590, Subdivision 4A2, says you get 2 years to bring that claim after the disposition of your direct appeal. It is not disputed that on February 25th of 2016, that's when the disposition of that direct appeal occurred. That's the date that the district court uses. That is the proper date in determining the disposition of the direct appeal. It's also not disputed that the post-conviction petition under 590 was filed on April 18th of 2019. That's 3 years, 1 month, and 24 days elapsed in between there. That's a month, 1 year, 1 month, and 24 days late. There are, of course, exceptions to the time bar. Those were not raised at the district court level. Wayne v. State, 570 Northwest 2nd, 389, that's a Minnesota Supreme Court decision from 2015, says that to not mention or not invoke any of those five exceptions is proper for the court to dismiss as untimely, just as the district court did here. The appellant makes reference now to Minnesota Statute 590.01, Subdivision 4B5, saying this is not frivolous and it's in the interest of justice. Let's, for the purpose of the argument on timeliness, let's accept that. If we accept that, and I'm certainly not accepting, and I will address the merits of that later, but just accepting that. Then the two-year clock starts running as the time the claim arises. That's what the statute tells us. So we still have that two-year clock. It's curious, though, that the appellate wants to fix that time for the arising, that the claim arises, and fix that on a determination by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Appellate wants to fix that on the filing of the Kirby and Otto decisions in July of 2017. Essentially, appellant's trying to say that the claim arises because of a decision by the Supreme Court. But that simply can't be. If we're to allow that to happen, if the court is to allow that to happen, anyone who's sentenced on a first or second degree controlled substance crime could use that as the date to fix the finality of their claim. It doesn't matter how long ago they were sentenced. Kirby and Otto do not apply on its plain language. They do. Kirby does not apply to appellant's case because her case was final. We know that that's the holding of Kirby because Justice Alito went to great lengths in the opinion to say this case is not about retroactivity, as appellant's counsel just said. It is about amelioration. And it applies to cases that are not yet final. So Kirby does not apply because her case was final. Appellant is asking this court to find that the wrong that requires this post-conviction review is ineffective assistance of counsel at the time of the dismissal of appeal, but then wants you to fix the date at the time of Kirby. So she wants it both ways. But what appellant is really trying to do is to revive this untimely claim, trying to make it not final, to use the Kirby language, to revive it. Changing the date on a carton of milk does not make the milk any less sour. Her claim is final. Her claim is untimely. And we'd ask the court to uphold the district court's denial of her petition for post-conviction relief. As to whether or not under subdivision 4 or 5, whether under, I should tell you, Minnesota Statute 590.01, subdivision 4, paren 5, whether she's established that it's not frivolous, her claim is not frivolous, and in the interest of justice, appellant correctly cites the five-part test. First issue is it with merit? Does it have merit? No, this is without merit.
All right, did you claim, though, Mr. Holitz, did you claim that appellant never raised the issue of the interest of justice exception before the district court?
That's, it's not raised in the briefing that, that I see.
All right.
It is raised in the brief that we have here, sort of in passing. Her claim is without merit because it's final. As I've already said, we look at the failure to raise an issue on direct appeal, and that doesn't apply in this situation because her direct appeal was dismissed, making this final. There was no error in the state's view. There is no fundamental unfairness to the defendant. Here, addressing Mr. McGrath's claims in the beginning, defendant accepted a favorable plea deal. She received a guideline sentence instead of a possible upward departure. She received the guideline sentence that was the law at the time. So there is no fundamental unfairness. As to the interest of justice, to protect the integrity of judicial proceedings, we know that finality is favored. When cases are final, they're final, and that's what's favored. To say that if only she would have continued to present to your honors a claim that had no merit on direct appeal, if only to preserve the right that maybe possibly the law would change in the future and she could somehow benefit, that does not preserve the interest of justice. Moving to the second issue, the ineffective assistance claim, whether or not this post-conviction petition under Minnesota Statute 590, this claim of ineffective assistance had any merit, the district court properly held that and addressed that issue. Even after finding that it was untimely, the district court addressed that issue and said that it did not have any merits. the district court correctly held that because looking at the framework, and the framework given to us by the U.S. Supreme Court in Strickland v. Washington, we know that in that first part of the two-part test, we have to look at was her appellate counsel so deficient? Did she make such serious errors, or did he make such serious errors that he was not functioning as that counsel that everyone is guaranteed under the Sixth Amendment? The question, and the district court's holding is totally appropriate, in holding that it was not reasonable to expect that appellate counsel would have anticipated the court's decision in Kirby decided 17 months in the future, and that that would somehow apply to appellant's case. We're talking about the amelioration doctrine. Most lawyers had never heard of this at the time Kirby was decided, let alone anticipated that it would have been used in the Kirby decision. It was not raised by the appellant in the Kirby decision. And the Supreme Court, arguments of the Supreme Court itself was divided 4-3 on that. It had not been used in 38 years until it was used in Kirby. Nobody saw this coming. So to hold that appellate counsel should have somehow known that maybe 17 months in the future this might apply and should have dragged out the case and presented a case with no merits to the Court of Appeals only with the hope that maybe it would, that cannot be ineffective assistance of counsel. The bottom line is that the dismissal of the appeal in this case was the only reasonable thing to do. It was ethical, it was appropriate, because there was no claim and no merit. But no claim of any merit, I should say, to bring before your honors. We'd ask the court to uphold the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And rebuttal.
Unless there's questions, I would rest on my feet, your honors.
Any questions?
Nope. Nothing further.
No, thank you, counsel, and thank you both. The matter will be taken under advisement, and an opinion will issue within 90 days.
Time
of the next? We got 10 minutes, I guess, once they're ready.